Our first guest this morning is going to be Jason Ware. He is the Chief Investment Officer at Albion Financial Group, and we're going to talk about the potential effect of the coronavirus, not on the world health situation, but on the economic and market situation. Jason, thank you for joining us on Mound Money.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, as our audience knows, it's in the news quite a bit. There's been over 70,000 coronavirus cases, and unfortunately, over 2,000 people have already died of the virus, which first appeared in the Chinese city of Wuhan in December of 2019. While this outbreak has been declared as a public health emergency of international concern, additional global impacts could be seen in other areas such as the economy. And to help us better understand the general markets and the coronavirus's impact on that, we've got Jason here to join us. And I guess where we want to start, Jason, is I know there's been a number of analyst reports that have come out trying to estimate what the economic impact could be. What are your thoughts on the potential impact of the coronavirus?
Right. And you know, I think at the end of the day, the scale of the impact of coronavirus on the global economy will be determined by how the virus spreads and how it evolves, which is admittedly a very difficult thing to predict, which is why we're seeing the fairly wide range of estimates that analysts are trying to assign to how this might impact the global economy. We've seen Goldman Sachs come out, for example, and say that it may take about 0.4% off of U.S. GDP in the first quarter. There have also been estimates from Oxford Economics that have placed a annual hit, if this were to, you know, truly get out of hand to become more of a global pandemic, as high as 1 to 1.1 trillion with a T in lost global output. So that's a really big range of estimates, and I think it just underscores how difficult it is to know in real time how this is going to play out. Just to give you some context on that $1 trillion number that Oxford is throwing around as part of their worst case scenario analysis, that would be the equivalent of about 1.3% reduction in global GDP growth. Now, that's not insignificant, but it's not recession either. Global growth has been trending at about 3% for the better part of the last couple of years. It's expected to grow by north of 3% over the next couple of years by most economic forecasts. So again, a notable slowdown could be the result of the coronavirus, but there's a wide range of potential outcomes.
So I know just watching the news, I can see that some of the economic impacts are going to come from travel, but what are the other components that play into the world economy and what this virus is doing?
Right. So that's a really interesting question. And it's interesting because, you know, we have some data points to look back on. I mean, obviously, we had SARS about 15 or some 17 years ago that I think sickened a little over 8,000 people, killed nearly 800. And by most estimates, you know, over a decade later, economists say that took about 2% off of China's GDP growth and impacted global growth by about 0.3%. Now, the reason that's an important data point in answering your question is in the 15 plus years since, global supply chains have actually become more interconnected. The global economy has become more interconnected and interdependent given the increase in world trade, given the opening of factories and retail stores, and like I said, global supply chains, etc. So we have a lot of cross-border dollars, cross-border capital flows, and because of that increased interconnectivity over the last decade or so, I think the impact, the potential impact beyond just travel and you know, leisure and general consumption can be seen in the gumming up of global supply chains. Like, for example, we had Apple earlier this week come out and say, you know what, next quarter's revenue might be a little bit less than we expected because, one, obviously we have a slowdown in demand if nobody's out spending in China, and two, because they're having a hard time getting access to the components they need in order to build their iPhones and build their watches, et cetera, and that can have a chilling effect on growth over the near term. So it can come from that supply chain element that wasn't quite as deeply entrenched, 15 years ago.
So Jason, you and I work together. I should share that with our audience. Your desk is next to mine, and we were together today at an event, and we were talking about Apple and some of the points you just raised. So what should the average investor do? Is this something that if people own Apple that they should think twice about, or do you think they should stay the course?
You know, I think for long-term investors, staying the course makes the most sense, not only with a great company like Apple, but with a broadly diversified equity portfolio as well. And I say that for a couple of reasons. First, the coronavirus, while certainly, you know, medically serious at present, and it could potentially have an impact on the global economy, is unlikely to be a truly fundamental change in the trajectory of the global economy and the trajectory of a company like Apple over the next 1, 3, 5, and 10 years. So as we look at investing for our clients, you know, we're sizing up companies based on whether or not we want to be owners of that business over the longer term. And while certainly the impact of the virus over the short run may be a slowing of growth, it may be increased costs to some of these businesses and costs to the economy, at the end of the day, we have to evaluate these things based on longer term fundamental merit. And we just don't anticipate the virus having a durable impact that warrants not owning a company like Apple.
Are there any companies or industries that you would see having concern with this type of global issue that's been going on?
Sure. I think there are pockets within certain sectors and certain industry groups that are going to have more challenging headwinds over the next 6 to 12 months. I mean, as you mentioned, you know, travel, you know, airlines, cruise lines, companies that have high concentration exposure to the Chinese consumer, semiconductor companies that are operating factories and production facilities in China. These companies are going to see material headwinds to their businesses. We happen to be in the midst of what's known as earnings season in the investment management community. It's where public companies report their quarterly earnings results. Right now, companies are reporting for Q4 2019, but they're obviously giving quite a bit of commentary on what is happening with their business currently. There have been a number of analysts and investors that have asked these management teams how coronavirus is impacting their business today. And what we're seeing by and large, if we screen across most of the S&P 500 companies, is that in about 40% of the cases, companies are recognizing the impact of the virus. A lot of them aren't quantifying it yet because we're just too early to tell how it's actually going to impact their sales and revenues, et cetera. But what we're seeing is a number of industrial companies and a number of these travel and leisure companies are suggesting that the impact is rather notable on their businesses. So there are areas that I think we'll see a short-term dip in their fundamentals. But again, if you're looking out, you know, in 2021, 2022, 2023, our best guess is that we'll look back and say, hey, remember when coronavirus was in the news? Just like we have with SARS, just like we did with MERS in 2012, just like we did with swine flu in 2009, and like we did with Ebola in 2014. So these things come and go, fortunately, and I think that'll be probably the enduring impact on most companies.
Well, Allison, I like your question about, you know, what industries are going to be impacted. Jason, part of your answer was leisure and entertainment. You know, certainly if you run a cruise line, now is not a good time, a good segment for you. We live in a ski town. We have people come from all over the world to our little town. It's how we make things work here. Jason, what's your thought? Are we likely to see an impact in Utah as a state, in Park City, from people maybe being a little fearful about getting on an airplane and going for a four-hour plane ride with people from all over the world?
All right, that's a really good question, Doug. And, you know, if you look at the stocks of companies that might signal what's happening with regards to travel and leisure here in the United States, you know, like, for example, Vail Resorts, I apologize, has had a fairly steady stock price throughout coronavirus. It hasn't changed much. It isn't signaling that there's any major dislocations in their business with regards to skiing and leisure. But I think broadly speaking, certainly the airline companies have all reported softer results and softer expectations relative to where they were before the coronavirus, but part of that is based on international travel. I think domestic travel, from what we're seeing in the data so far, is that there hasn't been much of an impact. I don't know of anyone personally in my network, for example, that has stopped going to restaurants or has not gone up the canyon to go skiing or is unwilling to get on a plane to go somewhere because of coronavirus, because at the end of the day, it just hasn't impacted the United States yet. I feel like the last time I looked at the data, we were less than 20 cases reported in the U.S., so it's fairly well contained. It seems to be, for the most part, in China. If you look at the 75,000 or so cases that have been reported, I believe less than 1,000 of them are outside of China. So I think as long as that continues to be the case, then the impact here locally, both at the national level in the U.S. and here in Utah, should be limited.
Now, you did mention the SARS epidemic back in 2002 and what that did to the overall world growth number. Back in 2002, China was 8% of the share of the global economy, and now they're at 19%. So just even with that change, are we going to see a greater percentage change because of it?
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to think about it. You know, as you noted, I mean, China's growth over the last 15 years has been remarkable. They are now the second largest economy in the world, and certainly when they see a major slowdown based on something like coronavirus and their economy effectively shuts it down. I mean, we're talking about, you know, retail stores being shuttered. We're talking about global supply chains that have been literally stalled and put on pause. We're, you know, financial centers that have shut down, government offices, et cetera. It's unlikely that we're not going to see some reverberation of that through the global economy. And again, because as you mentioned, they are a much larger piece of the overall pie. But nevertheless, I think even in the extreme model scenarios, it seems to suggest that a global slowdown in growth is to be expected, and it's unlikely to turn into anything deeper like a protracted recession or meaningful global downturn in economic activity. One other thing that I would mention is we have some evidence of a data point in between SARS and where we are today with the novel coronavirus, and that's swine flu in 2009. So that's 6 to 7 years past SARS, when the Chinese economy was larger than it was then, but not quite as large as it is today. And again, the impact to GDP in China from the swine flu was a little bit north of 1% by most estimates. And in turn, the impact on the global economy was about 0.5%. So again, a little bit more than SARS, but again not dire by any means. And we think that the likelihood of seeing something that is notable for the global economy, but not dire, is probably where we sit today, unless this were to truly spiral out of control from here.
Well, it may not have been dire for the global economy, but Park City was one of the first places that reported swine flu, and unfortunately, my daughter and I both caught it, and it was quite dire for our family. It was quite.
I remember that.
It was not a whole lot of fun. So hopefully, we do not repeat that with coronavirus. So,
right.
You know, I'm curious, Jason. So you mentioned the swine flu being kind of midpoint between SARS and where we are now with the coronavirus. Were these viruses to increase the cadence? Let's say that, you know, every 3 years we're dealing with something like that. Would that impact how you look at the fair price for the companies that you invest in?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, Doug. And I think if we were to see these types of epidemics or pandemics pick up in terms of how often we confront them, I think an argument could be made that a lower PE multiple on the market and a lower PE multiple on some of these growth businesses would be warranted, just because the unknown and the ability to predict with any kind of certainty on visibility into profits and cash flow and sales growth, et cetera, would be diminished. And with that diminished visibility into those revenue streams, one would probably pay a lower multiple for those businesses. So I think if we were to see something like that, where every year or 3 years we're dealing with something like this, it might exhaust investors to the point where they pay a little bit less for stocks. But that said, I don't think it completely invalidates the idea, the thesis, that owning good companies for the long term, and indeed a portfolio constructed, a diverse portfolio of good companies, is not in the best interest of most folks' long-term financial plans. So maybe the PE on the market, instead of being 17 times, is 16 times. But if we still have progress in the global economy, if we still have 3% growth, for example, in the global economy, and the U.S. is growing by 2%, and earnings are growing by 6 or 7%, and good growth companies underneath the surface of that are growing by 10, 15, 20, that is still a cocktail for good returns over the long term for a diversified portfolio of stocks.
So, as Doug had mentioned, what if the cadence increased? What if we start to see these impacts on the global economy more frequently? Are there ways we can look at our portfolio to balance it? Are there different types of industries we can look at investing? I mean, do I buy stock in the company that makes face masks?
You know, it's interesting you mention that, because I'm sure you saw in the news that they were running short on the supply of these face masks. So, you know, I think that's an interesting way to think about it. And I think in truth, there are probably going to be opportunities, assuming the cadence were to pick up and we were to face this more often, there are probably going to be companies that spring up, that innovate. And this, of course, is the nature of a dynamic economy and what makes investing so worthwhile and exciting, is that there are going to be companies that spring forth to create solutions for these problems if we start to face them in more regular fashion. And I think that provides an opportunity for investors to look at companies that are doing that. But I think outside of even like the innovative side of addressing that problem, the idea that you can avoid companies in certain sectors that have exposure to the global economy, if we were to see more of these pandemics, I think is one way to think about it. Companies that have more U.S.-centric revenue and profit and cash flow streams might be a way to think about it, because by and large, most of these epidemics and viruses have not come out of the United States. They typically come from other parts of the world. So if we wanted to think about insulating our portfolio, one might think more about a U.S.-based, U.S.-centric type business model. I think that's a way to think about potentially bringing down the risk of being exposed to these types of things. But again, I haven't heard anyone in the community that studies this, and certainly I'm not an expert, and none of us at Albion are experts in pandemics or epidemics, but most of the folks that do look at this and have modeled these things out are not predicting, at this point, any type of increased cadence. So I think that's the takeaway for your listeners, is that while I guess that's a possible risk, I mean, anything's possible, that's not the baseline scenario for most people that are doing forecasting here. And the likely result is, therefore, you continue to invest in your portfolio the way you would if coronavirus weren't in the news right now. And I think that's probably how we should think about this going forward.
So maybe there's a sense of urgency to go to the grocery store and pick up a bottle of Clorox, but not necessarily to call your broker and buy the stock of Clorox. So Jason, as we record this, as the audience knows, we're doing a construction project at the station, so we're recording this to minimize the construction sound during the show. But the recording date's February 19th. You talked about the impact on the economy of coronavirus. Let's back up a step and just get your views overall on the economy. Where are we now? There's a lot of people saying the market's really expensive. We are periodically hitting new highs. We've been pulling away from it, but we're hitting new highs. What's your views of the market for somebody that has a 3+ year time horizon?
Yeah. So the good news is that the economy, if you look across most of the evidence, the preponderance of data suggests that the economy is in a well-balanced position. We're not booming, but the economy is doing okay. The private sector looks good across company balance sheets, across household balance sheets. We have record high net worth. We have fairly low debt servicing costs. We have a fully employed economy by and large. We have consumption that continues to expand, whether that's retail sales or looking at things like real final demand. The consumer is healthy. The consumer is optimistic. Sentiment surveys seem to suggest that people feel pretty good about their economic situation. Businesses feel pretty good about where they sit, and they should. I mean, we are at record levels of cash on company balance sheets. Access to credit is there. We have money supply expanding. We have cheap credit because interest rates are low. So that's providing grease to the economic gears. So if we look at most of the information across the labor market, across the consumer, across interest rates, we have benign inflation. It's running below Fed target, around 1.5-1.6%, which means the economy is progressing because you don't want deflation, but it's not running hot where the Fed has to come in and raise interest rates. And indeed, we saw last year the Jerome Powell Fed delivered 3 rate cuts and what they called a mid-cycle adjustment, and I think that's helped provide additional support to the economy. So as we look at the economic foundation, we're encouraged by what we think is probably a 2-2.5% growth trajectory. That's been about what we've experienced for the better part of 10 years. Now, indeed, this has been a fairly long expansion, but the good news is that economic expansions don't die just because the calendar says it's getting old. They die because of excesses building in the economy, whether it's in consumer credit, whether it's in people being overconfident and spending beyond their means, whether it's the Fed coming in and having to over-tighten. Those are the kind of things that typically derail economic growth, and we're just not seeing excess in the economy right now. We're seeing, again, a fairly well-balanced environment. So that's the good news on the economy. And by extension, the stock market typically does well when the economy is expanding. Now, that doesn't mean we're not going to have some volatility. That doesn't mean we're not going to experience some dips and drawdowns in the market. Those are a feature, not a bug, of equity investing. But at the end of the day, a prolonged bear market is likely to be a function of two things. Either one, a recession, in other words, an economic downturn, a true quarter-over-quarter contraction in GDP, which, again, we think is a fairly low probability. And two, it would be an exogenous event, like a black swan type of event that inherently are difficult to predict, like coronavirus. But the good news is that based on what we're seeing so far, we think the likelihood of that causing a recession is fairly low. So outside of something that we can't predict, looking at the information we do have in front of us, we are optimistic the economy is doing okay, that the market is responding in kind and showing that the economy is doing okay by fairly strong returns in the market. Companies are doing well. Profitability continues to rise. We're probably going to see 6-7% growth in corporate earnings this year, which is good because stock prices follow earnings over the long term. So we're seeing a pretty a rosy, optimistic setup, I think. Now, that doesn't mean this year we're going to get strong returns in the stock market. You know, we don't know what the stock market is going to do this year. There's no way to know over the short term what equity returns are going to be. But we are optimistic as we look at the pillars that really support equity prices, and that is the economy and earnings, inflation, and interest rates and valuation. All of those things suggest that the position for the stock market looks pretty good.
Jason, thank you so much for your insights on the current market conditions as well as the impact that the coronavirus is having on the world economy. Really enjoyed having you here. Jason is with Albion Financial, and it looks like the likelihood of him having to come back and talk about the expansion of the impacts of coronavirus are less than perhaps we had anticipated. So thanks again for your time today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Jason. Always a pleasure.